Imagine buying like the most expensive heavy-duty art supplies in the world.
Right, the really high-end stuff.
Exactly. We're
Okay.
talking crushed, semi-precious stones, paper that's as thick as, well, industrial cardboard, and then using all of that intensive engineering just to paint a shadow.
It sounds completely counterintuitive.
It really does, but that is exactly what artist Jarrow Duke did. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are looking at this really fascinating watercolor painting from April 2025.
Yeah, it's titled 17 Pacto, right?
Yep, 17 Pacto, which is part of his broader series called Trastio Pittura Artistica. And our mission today for you, the listener, is to decode this. We're going to figure out how the raw literal chemistry of water and crushed stone transforms into this profound philosophical statement about our relationship with animals.
It's a huge leap from physical materials to, deep philosophy.
It is. So, okay, let's unpack this. Art can sometimes feel hidden behind all this inaccessible academic jargon, but today we're bringing it right down to earth. We're connecting the actual mechanics inside the artist's studio to the universal emotional archetypes you experience every single day.
And before we even get into the deep ethical philosophy of this specific painting, we really need to anchor it in physical reality
Yeah.
because art doesn't just magically manifest on a screen, it happens in matter.
Right. It takes up physical space.
Exactly. And looking at the source notes, the environmental context here is so crucial. This piece was created in Whittier, California.
Which, I mean, that changes the mental image completely, right?
Totally.
Because you often picture fine art being created in some sterile, climate-controlled vacuum, like a white-walled gallery. But Whittier in April means you are dealing with the actual physical heat of a Southern California afternoon.
You really are. You've got the ambient temperature, the dry air.
Yeah, and you can almost imagine the sweat, the concentration, and the actual friction of a wet brush scraping against the paper in that room. It gives it this living human context.
It does. And painting in that kind of dry, intense heat presents a very specific physical problem, which is water evaporates far too quickly.
Oh, right, because it's a watercolor.
Exactly. So to survive that environment and like maintain any sort of control over a fluid medium, the artist cannot use standard materials. The medium actually has to fight back against the climate.
Wow, okay. So what does he use?
Duke uses Arches watercolor paper, but specifically the 640 gram cold press coarse grain variety.
Okay, for anyone who hasn't spent much time in a niche art supply store, 640 gram paper is essentially structural engineering.
It really is. It's massive.
Just to give you an idea, standard printer paper is around 80 grams, and even normal, decent watercolor paper hovers around 300 grams.
Yeah.
So at 640, you are dealing with a surface that literally feels like rigid cardboard.
Yeah, it's thick, it's heavy, and it has an incredibly aggressive texture to it.
It feels like such a contradiction, though. Using this heavy, rigid, cardboard-like paper for something as delicate and fluid as watercolor. It's like, I don't know, it's like trying to write a delicate poem on a rustic stone wall.
That's a great way to put it. But the mechanics of that heavy paper are actually what make the atmospheric effects in 17 Pacto biologically and physically possible.
How so?
Well, when we look at standard thin paper under a microscope, adding heavy amounts of water causes the cellulose fibers to swell unevenly.
Oh, so it buckles.
Right, it buckles, it warps, and it totally destroys any optical illusion the artist is trying to build because the water just starts pooling unpredictably in all those warped craters.
So using a liquid medium on a flat, thin surface is just a recipe for chaos in that environment.
Complete chaos.
It sounds less like painting on a smooth canvas and more like pouring water over a rugged topographical map, where the paper itself is dictating where the lakes of pigment end up.
That topographical map analogy is the exact mechanism happening here. Because this 640 gram paper is cold pressed and coarse grain, it features this rugged terrain of microscopic valleys and crests.
Okay, I see.
It acts as a structural retaining wall. It is so thick that it can hold these massive puddles of water in those tiny valleys without bending even a fraction of an inch.
Wow. So it provides a highly controlled scaffolding for the fluid chaos of the water.
Precisely.
So the extreme heaviness of the paper gives him the structural freedom to just flood the canvas.
Yes, and that brings us to what he is actually flooding it with.
Right, the pigments. The source notes highlight the use of Daniel Smith pigments. Hmm. And these aren't your average, you know, synthetic dyes formulated in a chemistry lab to just stain the paper a certain color.
No, not at all. Synthetic dyes are essentially just color molecules suspended in a binder. They wash over the paper very evenly and honestly synthetically.
Right.
Daniel Smith pigments, on the other hand, are made from literal crushed stones and real minerals.
Like actual rock.
Yeah. Things like hematite or lapis lazuli. Because of that, they retain their physical mass.
Okay, wait, let me wrap my head around this. So we have crushed rocks mixed with water sitting on top of this heavy, mountainous paper in the dry heat of a California studio.
That is the exact setup. And this is where the physics of the environment take over as, like, an active collaborator in the art.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, when Duke lays down a heavy wash of this mineral-laced water for the background sky, he literally just steps back.
He lets it do its thing.
Right. As the dry California air accelerates the evaporation of the water, gravity acts on the minerals. Because they are actual crushed stones, they're heavy.
Oh, wow. So gravity pulls them down?
Exactly. Gravity pulls those heavy particles down off the microscopic crests of the paper, and they settle deeply into the lowest parts of those valleys.
So the environment is basically chemically painting the picture alongside him. The water evaporates, the heavy stones sink, and it creates this organic microtexture.
It's incredible. It results in these granulations and sprawling patterns that no human hand could ever artificially replicate with a brush. I don't care how skilled the painter is.
It's nature doing the work.
Yeah, the paper and the gravity do half the work to create this impossibly rich, glowing sunset sky that makes up the background of the piece.
Okay, so we have this incredibly luminous, organically textured sunset sky born out of the fluid dynamics of water and crushed stone.
Huh.
We totally get the high-end materials, the structural paper, and that chemical collaboration with gravity.
Right, the physical foundation is laid.
And here's where it gets really interesting, but also a bit counterintuitive for me. In front of this masterpiece of a sky, the main subjects of the painting, a human and a dog, are painted entirely as dark, opaque silhouettes. The notes refer to this as a contraluce.
Yes, a contraluce, which literally translates to against the light. It's a stark backlight where the light source is directly behind the subject, throwing the foreground into complete shadow.
And I have to push back on the artist's choice here.
Go for it.
If he went through the trouble of sourcing this structural retaining wall of a paper and these magical gravity-driven mineral pigments, and he obviously possesses profound technical mastery, isn't it a waste to just paint the main subjects as dark, opaque blobs?
I completely hear you.
I mean, why choose to show less detail when you have the capacity to show every single hair on a dog? If you can paint the golden light catching the fur or the intricate folds of the human's clothing, why reduce them to shadows?
It's a super valid question, and honestly, it is the most common hurdle people face with contemporary synthesis in art.
Synthesis?
Yeah. Synthesis in this context means distilling something complex down to its absolute bare essential structure to convey a concept. So why hold back when you have the skill to show off? We have to look at the cognitive mechanism of how human psychology processes visual information.
Okay, I'm with you.
If Duke used those expensive pigments to paint a hyper-realistic golden retriever with a shiny red collar sitting next to a middle-aged man wearing, say, a blue denim jacket,
yeah,
your brain processes that data very specifically.
My brain categorizes it as someone else. I'd look at it and think, oh, what a nice painting of that specific man and his specific dog.
Exactly.
I'd admire the technique, but I'd just remain an outsider looking through a window at someone else's anecdote.
Bingo. What's fascinating here is that by stripping away all of those realistic, literal details, the fur, the clothes, the facial expressions, the figures cease being individuals. They transform into universal emotional archetypes.
They become a blank slate.
Basically, yeah. The human brain is an aggressive pattern-matching machine. When it sees the outline of a dog and a person but no facial features or specific data, it panics. It hates a data vacuum.
But wait, doesn't that make the artist, I don't know, a bit lazy?
How do you mean?
Well, if the whole point is just to create a mirror for my emotions to project onto, why doesn't he just hang a literal mirror on the gallery wall? Why do we even need the silhouette of the dog at all?
Because a literal mirror only reflects your current physical state. It just shows you standing in a room. It doesn't guide your emotional recall.
Oh, that makes sense.
The artist isn't being lazy at all. He's providing a highly specific cognitive framework. The silhouette acts as a scaffold. By giving you the shape of an interaction but withholding the internal data, the artist hacks your brain's natural instinct to complete the picture.
So to fill that data vacuum, my brain has to reach into its own memory banks to supply the missing pixels.
Exactly. The silhouette of the dog becomes your childhood dog. The human becomes you.
Wow. So by withholding visual data, he is essentially demanding emotional participation from you, the viewer. The shadow isn't an absence of art. It is a psychological mechanism forcing you to co-author the painting.
That's beautifully said. Less visual detail demands more emotional labor from the listener. The painting is intentionally incomplete.
And understanding that these silhouettes function as universal mirrors allows us to finally examine the architecture of what these figures are actually doing in the painting. Which brings us to the title of the work, 17 Paco, or Pact.
Right, and the physical posture of these two archetypes is really the entire engine of the piece.
Yeah, if you look at the silhouette, you see a human who is crouched all the way down to the ground, facing a seated dog. They're completely eye to eye.
It's a very intentional pose.
It is, and we need to actively contrast this with centuries of classical art history.
Uh-huh.
If you walk through any major museum and look at grand Renaissance portraits or, you know, a classic painting by Velázquez, the human-animal dynamic is incredibly rigid.
Oh, absolutely.
The human, usually the king, a nobleman, or some aristocratic hunter, is always standing tall, projecting absolute dominance. And the dog is positioned way down at their feet, acting almost like a decorative rug or a symbol of blind obedience.
It is a strict vertical hierarchy. The physical height dictates the entire power dynamic.
Think about it. Standing up over a dog is a biomechanical imposition of authority. It's the exact same dominance as a boss looming over your desk while you are sitting in a subordinate chair.
That's a really good analogy.
The person towering over the other controls the space. So when you crouch down, you are literally stepping off your evolutionary pedestal.
You are actively dismantling the vertical hierarchy. And this raises a fascinating point about evolutionary psychology and biomechanics.
Tell me more.
Biologically speaking, dogs are descendants of wolves. They are predators with teeth and deeply ingrained survival instincts. Their threat response is directly triggered by height, by looming figures, and by being stared down from above.
Right, because looming triggers a fight-or-flight nervous system response.
Correct.
It means you're about to be attacked.
Exactly. So for a human to intentionally descend to lower their center of gravity, bringing their face and throat down to the exact eye level of a biological predator, it is an act of supreme vulnerability. It's a profound de-escalation.
You are entering their striking distance just to prove that they don't need to strike?
Yes. You cannot dictate or command from that physical position. You can only relate.
So what does this all mean for the painting? Because I think this really decodes the concept of the pact.
It absolutely does. Because a command, like telling a dog to sit or stay, is imposed from a position of vertical power. It relies on authority and intimidation. But a pact is an entirely different mechanism. A pact requires mutual, silent consent. It requires two parties who view each other as equals on a horizontal plane.
It's not master and pet anymore.
No, the painting captures the exact fraction of a second where the animal is recognized as an equal partner with its own agency. It isn't forced to obey. It chooses to engage. If you look closely at the silhouette, the dog is extending its paw.
It is a bidirectional promise.
Mm.
That's incredible. It rewrites the entire concept of ownership into a true society of coexistence. The human promises loyalty, respect, and protection, and the animal returns it entirely voluntarily.
And it's an ethical manifesto built purely through the biomechanics of lowering your center of gravity.
It really is.
It is a physical manifestation of empathy. Empathy always requires you to abandon your high ground. You have to step off the pedestal of your own perceived superiority and meet the other being exactly where they are in their own territory, right on their own eye level.
Let's pull all of these threads together because the journey of this piece and this whole deep dive is pretty remarkable.
It covers a lot of ground.
We started in a very physical, tactile space, this hot studio in Whittier, California, looking at 640-gram rigid cardboard-like paper acting as a structural retaining wall.
Right, anchoring us in the physical reality of the materials.
And we saw how the artist leverages fluid dynamics, heavy water, and crushed mineral pigments, basically allowing gravity to paint its own luminous, heavily textured atmospheric sky.
The chemistry of the canvas.
Exactly. And from that chemistry, we move straight into cognitive psychology. We analyze the concept of contemporary synthesis and that contrailist silhouette.
We saw how the brain hates a data vacuum.
Yeah, and how stripping away literal details hacks our pattern matching instincts, turning those dark shadows into universal emotional mirrors that require our own memories to finish the artwork.
And finally, we decoded the architecture of the posture itself. We witnessed the dismantling of a centuries-old vertical hierarchy.
Just by crouching down. By simply crouching down to eye level, the human archetype completely de-escalates the evolutionary threat response, replacing command and dominance with a profound ethical pact of interspecies respect.
It's a beautiful synthesis of material and meaning.
It really is. And hey, if you want to experience this cognitive projection for yourself, you can find the reference image linked to artcolorregale.com. Just look at those shadows and see whose memories your brain uses to fill in the missing pixels.
I highly recommend doing that. And, you know, the mechanics of that physical humility we've been talking about, they carry a weight that extends far beyond just how we interact with animals.
Oh, absolutely.
We've spent this time analyzing how a physical gesture as simple as crouching down to eye level can completely heal, dignify, and transform our relationship with another species. But the question to mull over is how that applies to the rest of your world.
Because that vertical hierarchy doesn't just exist between humans and dogs. I mean,
yeah.
We build those exact same pedestals in our offices, our romantic relationships, and our arguments.
We do. We try to loom over people. So what would happen in your own daily life if you applied this exact same biomechanical and psychological humility to the people around you?
That's a tough question.
It is. The next time you find yourself facing a conflict, a misunderstanding, or a tense negotiation with another human being, what would actually change if you consciously decided to step off your self-imposed pedestal?
Wow.
What if you abandoned the need to loom over the situation, drop the vertical hierarchy entirely, and chose to meet them eye to eye, right at ground level?
Just the willingness to enter that vulnerable space could change the entire paradigm of how we connect with each other. It really proves that sometimes the most profound strength is found simply in lowering your center of gravity.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive today and for bringing your curiosity to the table as always. Until next time, keep looking past the obvious and we will catch you on the next one.